please be turning in your Bibles to the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth, chapter 1. Tonight's study will be a little different than our normal method of study. We're going to spend our time tonight in Ruth chapter 1, so I encourage you to get your Bibles and to be turning there. And I'm going to make a deal with you. If you turn there in your Bibles, I will not be asking you to turn anywhere else. We're going to sit in Ruth 1. We're not going anywhere else. We're going to start in Ruth chapter 1 tonight. And my plan is, on the third Sunday night of every month, to study through this book until we're done. So since Ruth is four chapters for the next 3 months, on the third Sunday night, we're going to be looking at one chapter of Ruth, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And we're going to do so in a similar fashion. I must confess that I'm excited for the study. The book of Ruth, as we normally consider it, is, as with Daniel in the lion's den this morning, we oftentimes delegate that to our children's classroom. And as we read through the book of Ruth, usually what we walk away with, aside from an engaging and endearing story of loyalty and love, is a story that just makes you feel good. As you read about Naomi and you see how she's full of life, you start out high with her, and as she begins to experience loss, you go low with her. And then once again, as God's goodness is restored to her, you just come away from the story feeling good. But so oftentimes, books like this are oftentimes read solely for the surface level lessons that you might learn. Reading through the book of Ruth, what would you walk away with? Well, things like, if you're loyal like Ruth, and if you're kind and you're generous like Boaz, then God will bless you. God will be good to you. And that's usually, I think, the extent of what we take away from books like that. We don't oftentimes dive very deeply into these lessons. Would you be surprised to know that there are some deep yet subtle theological lessons that we can gain from this book? One of the primary ones being similar to what we're finding out in Daniel is this idea of providence. That is, God's working in a non-miraculous sense, using the laws of nature that are in effect to bring about His purposes, to bring about His desires in the life of people, in the life of His people. This is a deep concept, but yet it permeates this book, as you're going to find out as we study through it. There aren't any supernatural events, and there aren't any miracles that really punctuate what's happening in the life of Ruth and in the life of Naomi. But as the attentive reader finishes studying the book and finishes reading, you're absolutely sure that God's hand is there behind the scene, orchestrating everything that comes about. It's also said that in the Old Testament, that everything in the Old Testament points to Jesus. And you may be wondering, if you know the story of Ruth, well, how in the world does that point to Jesus? Well, I believe that the book of Ruth, simply put, tells the story of Jesus. And I hope that by the time we finish chapter 4, and after we've looked at the old book, that you're able to understand what I mean, that you're able to see and appreciate these concepts that you don't get from just reading through the book and looking at the very surface level lessons. I want to take us a little deeper, and I'm excited for this study. I tell you, I've just studied chapter 1, spent a couple of days studying that, and I have a very great appreciation for it. I want to show you God in this book. I want you to understand and appreciate some of the deeper things that are there, deeper than the surface level reading. And so I hope that you'll have your Bibles open and that you'll be looking with us as we study from Ruth chapter 1 and then the subsequent following chapters throughout the upcoming months. Just a little bit about the book. In our English Bibles, which are arranged somewhat chronologically, the book of Ruth follows the book of Judges. And it's during the days of the Judges that the life of Ruth and Naomi take place. We have somewhat of a chronological order to ours. But if you go back to the Hebrew Bible, their arrangement of the Bible, they place Ruth at the end of Proverbs and right before Song of Solomon. Can you think of why that might be? Remember how Proverbs ends? Proverbs chapter 31, we know the account of the virtuous woman, the virtuous wife. They place Ruth, that virtuous wife, right at the end of Proverbs 31. Song of Solomon, you've got a woman that takes a very strong role, an active role in pursuit of that relationship. And that's what you've got here with Ruth, we're going to find out as we begin studying this book. So the arrangement in the Hebrew Bibles, somewhat interesting, I find. But Ruth is a story and a tale that warms the heart. It's a story that draws you in, and it lets you see God's heart. It's really a beautiful book, and I hope that you're ready to study from it this evening and give a few moments of your time to consideration of some of the things we'll find in chapter 1. So let's just begin our reading in Ruth chapter 1. Let's look at the first five verses, please. Ruth 1, beginning in verse 1. It came to pass in the days when the judges ruled the land, there was a famine in the land. A certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, the name of his wife was Naomi, and the name of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they went to the country of Moab and remained there. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. Now they took wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one was Orpah, the name of the other, Ruth. And they dwelt there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died. So the woman survived her two sons and husband. So we see, based off of verse 1, the time frame for when the book of Ruth occurred. I told you that it was added to our Bibles at the end of the book of Judges. And as we read the very first verse there, the author records for us, he sets the stage of when the story of Ruth occurred. That it was when the judges ruled the land. Now you may be well acquainted with the period of the judges. It was that period of Israel's history prior to them having a king, before King Saul and King David and Solomon came along, when various individuals would rise up, and it very much highlights Israel's circle of sin that occurred over and over and over. And when you go back and you read through the book of Judges, the idea, the premise behind the entire book, Israel's history for those 400 years or so, is that every man did what was right in his own eyes. That phrase is used in multiple occasions in the book of Judges and highlights what it's about. Idolatry and unfaithfulness and harlotry, spiritual unfaithfulness, are repeated over and over and over. And you see God's people fall after foreign idols, fall after foreign gods. Then they cry out to God after God punishes them and God forgives them, sends them a judge to deliver them. And this occurs some 13 or 14 times all throughout the book. And as you read through the book of Judges, I don't know about you, but it just kind of takes the air out of you to see God's people and their unfaithfulness, not once, not twice, but so many times. And it just makes you wonder, why does He keep forgiving them? You really understand God's goodness when you read the book of Judges. You really understand God's mercy and God's long-suffering with His people. But then you come to the book of Ruth, which was during the same time of that period of the judges, Israel's dark hour, one of the many dark hours Israel had. And as you read the book of Ruth, it lets the air back into it. It makes you feel good. It reminds you that even though all these terrible things are taking place, there's still good people out there. And there's still good things happening. And God's still working among His people. And the short genealogy at the end of the book of Ruth, in chapter 4, don't look at that. But there's a short genealogy at the end. And if it corroborates Matthew's genealogy, which it does, then what we find out, and you once again wonder, where does Ruth fit into the big picture of the Bible? What we find out is that Ruth is, I believe, the great-grandmother of David. David from whom would come one that would bless all of the nations. Ruth was the great-grandmother, or I've got grandmother, of David. And so the time frame of the book of Ruth would likely be during the days when Jephthah, or Samson, judged Israel. And as chapter 1 tells us that it was during the days of these judges, we find out that during the days of Ruth and during the days of Naomi and her husband Elimelech, there was a famine in the land. So our timeline that was previously mentioned helps us understand just a little bit why there might have been a famine in the land. Remember, Judges highlights it and captures for us a repetitive cycle of sin throughout Israel's history. And when Israel would go after these foreign gods, God would punish them. He'd do so by bringing in their enemies who would sometimes enslave them for a period of time. He'd do that through things such as famine, as we see here. And so when you see and you read about the famine that occurred in the book of Ruth, very obviously because it was during one of those dark periods when Israel had fallen away after other gods and God had judged or punished His people with this famine. The only trouble is that sometimes whenever God judges the wicked, as He was doing the wicked, unfaithful Israelites, sometimes you've got good people that get caught up in alongside that sort of judgment and that sort of trouble. And that's what we find Naomi and her husband Elimelech experiencing. And so we're introduced to this family from the city of Bethlehem in the tribe of Judah. The husband's name is Elimelech, and Naomi, the children, Mahlon, two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. we can't truly imagine the effect of this famine that's described here for us in the book of Ruth. Think about that. All of our food is in the refrigerator. We've got our shelves and our pantry stocked full of stuff. We could have no crops. We could have no food provided for us. And we'd be okay for a good long while because of the blessings, the physical blessings that God's given us. And so we can't understand really the repercussions and the terribleness of something as famine coming out and striking the land. Starvation would be frequent. It'd be there on every turn. As a result of malnutrition, you'd have diseases running rampant all throughout the people. There'd be perpetual thirst. There'd be a death of plant life. Animals would be dropping dead because there just wasn't water for them to drink and there wasn't food for them to eat. That's what's taking place in the days of Israel during the life of Elimelech and Ruth. And that's exactly what it is that they're seeking to avoid, because God was judging Israel. We're told here that Elimelech takes his family, he uproots them, and he goes to the land of Moab. Now, we've got here for us a little map, and I've tried to highlight there a little red path there that they probably would have taken, heading from Bethlehem, and Bethlehem's right there, that little dot about 5 miles south of Jerusalem. They would have headed up north to Jerusalem. They'd have got on this road here, and they would have went north over the Dead Sea to this road right here, and they would have went straight south down into the city of Moab. The trip would have been about 70 to 100 miles and probably would have taken 7 to 10 days. But that's what we read about. We read about Elimelech, because of this famine, uprooting his family, his wife, his two sons, and traveling to the land of the Moabites. You understand why it is a man would do something like this during such a circumstance. Recall what Jacob did with his family whenever there was a famine throughout the land in the book of Genesis. He took his sons, he took his wives, and they went to the land of Egypt where there was food. And so as they're seeking out refuge, as they're seeking out resources and sustenance, this man takes his family, leaves Bethlehem, and goes and dwells among the Moabites, we're told. And as we get over there, we find out that for Naomi, disaster strikes. Verse 3 tells us that while they're there in the land of Moab, Elimelech, her husband, dies. Ladies, perhaps you can appreciate the way this might feel in a different sense, in a more realistic sense. This woman, Naomi, she's now been widowed in this foreign land. Her husband is gone. No doubt, part of the inherent fear is for her two sons now. Moms, particularly. Moms with sons. You ever been concerned, what kind of girl is my daughter? What kind of girl is my son going to marry? We understand the implications. We understand the influence that relationship has on individuals. No doubt every mother here with sons has wondered and has prayed and has spent many hours beseeching God that their sons might find godly wives. And no doubt part of Naomi's fear is now she's here in this foreign land in Moab. We're not talking about people that share her faith. We're not talking about people that worship Yahweh. We're talking about unbelievers. No doubt her fear is that her sons, like the nation of Israel, might take some of these Moabite women as wives and that they might influence them and lead them away from God, the very thing that Israel is being judged for at this point in time. Perhaps she wonders, did I make a mistake in leaving Bethlehem, in leaving my home where my people were? I know things were bad there, but did I make a mistake moving to the land of the Moabites? Her two sons take wives, we're told. In verse 4, the name of the one is Orpah, and the name of the other is Ruth. I said we see providence very frequently throughout the book of Ruth. We see God's hand behind the screen orchestrating things. Her two sons marry, but man, I bet they married the only two decent girls in the land of Moab. The happiness of this family is short-lived. In verses 4 and 5, we find out not only has her husband Elimelech died, within 10 years after her sons have taken wife, both Mahlon and Chilion also die. So now this woman Ruth has been widowed. She's been left childless. She's in the land of Moab, away from her people, with her two daughter-in-laws. Things are just falling apart. It's about as terrible as things could be. I want you to appreciate for just a moment the plight that a childless widow would have. The terror that she felt whenever her husband died, no doubt was exasperated many times over whenever her two sons died. That which was previously fear has now become unfettered terror. She's in this foreign land. She's away from her people and away from her God. All she has in her presence are these two Moabite daughter-in-laws. Understand the position she'd be in. Widows were without social, political, or economic status. They had no male protector. They would simply be at the mercy of society to demonstrate to them some kindness and provide them protection and shelter. And that's the situation that Naomi was in. Now, God had provided a means for Jewish widows, but Naomi wasn't in Israel. She was in the land of Moab. And the Moabites didn't govern themselves with such principles as God's people did. The widow without any children, without a husband, would be very similar to the homeless that are in our country, just at the mercy of the goodness and generosity of society. Let's continue our story, beginning in verse 6. She arose with her daughters-in-law, that she might return from the country of Moab. For she had heard that in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people by giving them bread. Therefore she went out from the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her. And they went on their way to the land, return to the land of Judah. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each to your mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband." So she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. We see the Lord remembers his people. We see God once again working behind the scene. In our worldview, our perspective, the way that we look at this world, we will look at this event that occurs. We identify first human cause and then recognize it as being governed by God. It rained again in the land of Israel. They have bread. Of course, God brought that about. But their worldview was completely different. Do you notice the statement in verse 6, how they described that? It wasn't that it rained and that there was bread and God was behind it. It wasn't the worldly cause and then the divine behind that. It was simply the Lord had visited his people by giving them bread. That is, they have things in reverse as to we do. They place God at the forefront, working then through natural means to bring about what it is he seeks to accomplish. I'm more inclined to really go with this worldview, to agree with the author of this book, that it's God who first acts and brings about his will through natural law. And I was telling Whitney this afternoon, I sometimes think that we just don't give God enough credit for working in our life. Normal things that occur, is that God working in our life? Maybe it is. Maybe it's time and chance that was mentioned in our Bible class on Wednesday night. But maybe it is God working in our life. Maybe we do need to give more credit to God. Because as we read through this book, we see God's involvement through the use of ordinary and normal means. This nation has obviously turned back to God. Remember, famine had previously been taken in the land. They must have turned back to God and repented because God had now blessed the people. He'd given them bread. He'd blessed the nation once again. They've obviously come back to Him. And here's Naomi with no husband and no children. Perhaps at the very least, if she returns home, she might come across some friends who remember her. Some friends who extend to her some generosity or some compassion and some pity. And so she and her daughter, she prepares to return to Judah. I'd mentioned, Mahlon and Chilion must have married the only two good girls in Moab. And as we look at this book, we say Ruth is the special one. That's absolutely true. Ruth was obviously a generous and kind and loyal and loving woman. No doubt, as that's going to be manifested for us throughout the story. But Orpah was right there with her for the time being. Orpah was just as willing to go. Orpah was just as willing to uproot herself. We read that in verse 7. Therefore, she went out from the place where she was, and her two, not one, her two daughter-in-laws went with her. So as she prepared to return to the land of Judah, both Orpah and Ruth arose to go back with Naomi. Naomi has no. She's got no husband. She's got no children. She's got no distant relatives close by. The best choice for her at this point is to go back home to her town of Bethlehem. And in verse 8, as she responds to Naomi, as she responds to Ruth, and as she responds to Orpah, it's somewhat odd. She says, "Go, return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with me." These are young ladies she's talking to, young widows themselves. They can marry again. Unlike her, who has no family, who has no future here in the land of Moab, they can find other men. They can go back to their mother's houses. They can remarry. They can have a family. It's can't help but wonder, though, as you see their response, whenever Naomi prepares to go back to the land of Judah, they were right there beside her. As you read through this, I can't help you, can't but think you ask the question, what was it about Naomi? What was it about Naomi that caused such fierce loyalty of these two women to be engendered to her? We can only guess. Her kindness, her love, what might it have been? Her influence and her company? It says a lot that these two young widows who were still able to find a future and a home in the land of Moab would be willing to give up their people, their home, their stability, their extended family, everything that they might have in the land of Moab, the potential to one day marry again and have children. They were willing to give that up to go with Naomi back to Judah. Why? I wish y'all would have known. We don't know what that was. We can only guess. But she obviously had a profound effect on them. But you see an air, and maybe this is a little bit of it, you see an air of selflessness with Naomi as her two daughter-in-laws arise with her, and as they prepare to make the long trek back to Judah with her. Surely having them for company and for comfort and for companionship, man, that made that long journey just a little bit easier to know that her two daughter-in-laws were loyal and beside her, traveling back with her because of the love that they had for her. Yet what does she do? She entreats them to go back. She tries to get them to stay, and I believe for a very selfless reason. She doesn't believe going back to the land of Judah will be in their best interest. She thinks staying in their home where they have roots, where they have family, where they have people that can care for them, where they might have one day a future, would be in their best interest. And so she tells them, you need to stay here, girls. May the Lord grant you the rest that you've given me when you find a husband. Let's continue reading our story in verse 10. They said to her, surely we will return with you to your people. But Naomi said, turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Are there still sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Turn back, my daughters, go, for I'm too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, if I should have a husband tonight and should also bear sons, would you wait for them till they were grown? Would you restrain yourselves from having husbands? No, my daughters, for it grieves me very much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. And they lifted up their voices, and they wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law. After initially being entreated to go back to Moab, they still desire to continue to go with Naomi to Judah. And Naomi's response is a little bit odd, isn't it? That's where the benefit of studying and staying within this context helps us understand what it is, what thought process might be going in her mind when she would make some odd declaration. Who Naomi, obviously, who's too old to bear children, is able to say, what are you going to do? I can't have children. Even if I could and I were to have children, would you wait around so that one of them might marry you? That's somewhat of an odd response for her to have to these two young ladies. What Naomi is alluding to, however, is what's called the levirate law. You stay where you are in Ruth 1. We're going to read a passage from Deuteronomy 25 that explains what the levirate law was. It's part of the old law given by God. This is what it said. If brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the widow of the dead man shall not be married to a stranger outside the family. Her husband's brother shall go into her, take her as wife, perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And it shall be that the firstborn son which she bears will succeed the name of the dead brother. That is, his name might not be blotted out of the land of Israel. And so essentially the way the levirate law worked, if a woman had multiple sons and one of the sons took a wife, he died without fathering any children, the next oldest son would step in, would marry the woman, would father a child, and get this, the son would not be his, it would be his brother's, so that his brother's name might not be blotted out of the land of Israel. And so when Naomi makes this odd response, what are you going to do, wait for me to have more sons and then one day marry them? That's what she's got in mind. Now, the situation wouldn't be exact. But if she were to have children and she were to have sons, then when those sons grew up, by levirate law, they would have then married Orpah and Ruth. That's where that comes from when Naomi makes that somewhat odd statement for us. But she's got to spell it out to them. Girls, you don't have a future with me. I'm too old to have children. Even then, if I were to have children, by the time they grew up and could marry you, you might be too old for families of your own. And so she spells it out for them in no uncertain terms. coming with me offers you absolutely no blessing, no benefit. There's nothing good from you coming with me. And their love for one another is mutual. But you see her selflessness. She's lost her son. She's lost her husband. She's about to lose her daughter-in-laws. But yet, look what she says. Verse 13. That's actually not 3. Verse 13. She says, "My daughters, it grieves me very much for your sake." Once again, you see kind, selfless Naomi. Maybe that's what it was that really endeared these girls to her. After all she lost, she's not thinking about Naomi. She's thinking about her daughters-in-law. "It grieves me very much for your sake." That she can look at anyone else right now and that she can feel pity for them and she can feel compassion for them after everything she lost really says a lot about her love for her daughters-in-law. And the statement she makes there is that which we so oftentimes see whenever disaster strikes, isn't it? "The hand of the Lord has gone out against me." As we often say when tragedy strikes, who is it that takes the blame? Was God. Was she right in blaming God? We know that God was involved in the circumstance. We know, however, also that God has a plan for Naomi and for Ruth. And our inability to see God's perfect plan, oftentimes, as it does in this moment with Naomi, it sends us spiraling into this doubt in which we might say, "God is at fault. The hand of the Lord is against me." Maybe we feel that way in those times, that God's hand has gone out against us. Maybe that's why they followed Naomi so devoutly. Because they had just a small fraction of the hope that God would bless, that her God would bless her, and through extension of blessing her, that they might be blessed as well. That they believed at some point in time in her life, God would again remember her. And it's finally at this point in time, did you notice? Previously she couldn't shake him. It's finally at this point in time when she says, "The hand of the Lord has gone out against me," that we find out Orpah kissed her mother-in-law and departed. Let's continue our reading, picking up again in verse 14. They lifted up their voices, they wept again. Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And she said, "Look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you will go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I'll be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts you and me." When she saw that she had determined to go with her, she stopped speaking to her. What was the difference, you think, between Orpah and Ruth? Both had love and loyalty and faithfulness for Naomi, and it took some convincing. But Naomi was finally able to get Orpah to go back to her family. She laid out the argument from every angle so that she was clearly able to see there's nothing for me with you, for you with me. And Orpah finally gives in and goes back to her home. And both these women were loyal and kind and were willing to sacrifice themselves for their mother-in-law. But what was it that kept Ruth there with Naomi? I think verse 18 tells us. When Naomi saw Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped speaking to her. That was the difference. Orpah had finally been talked into leaving by Naomi. Ruth wasn't going to have it. She was determined. She'd made up her mind. She was going with Naomi. You ever spoke to someone who's hard-headed? You try to be logical with them and they just won't hear it. Got a buddy right now that's wanting to get a small aircraft license, and I told him, "Man, you're going to end up getting yourself killed." And I've shown them statistics, and I've shown them, you get one of these things, your chance of not living increases significantly. He won't hear it. Stubborn as a mule, the guy is. That must have been like what it was for Naomi to speak to Ruth. "I'm not going to have any of it. I'm not going anywhere." You can't talk any sense into her. You try to be logical, they won't hear it. When Naomi came to this conclusion, Ruth was determined to go. She quit trying to convince her. She stopped speaking to her. The difference between the two girls was simply determination. And Ruth's determination was shown for us in that response that she made to Naomi. Such a beautiful and eloquent response from a young woman whose loyalty and love for her mother-in-law exceeds her care and concern for what's best for her. It's been thought by many people as they've read through Ruth's response that, well, her loyalty was truly to Naomi. She didn't have really any loyalty to God, but her loyalty was for Naomi and Naomi alone. The statement here, your God shall be my God. As that's interpreted in our Bibles, we may see perhaps a little bit of loyalty from Ruth toward God. However, that word God there that's used in Hebrew is the word Elohim. The word Elohim can be used in reference to God our Father. But it can also be used in reference to gods of the heathens as well. And so you really have to allow context to determine what it is Elohim means. We see in this instance it's translated God as in the God that we serve, the God that Naomi served. But some have looked at this and said, based off of her statement, she uses the word Elohim. She's saying, whatever God or gods you serve, Naomi, I'm going to serve because of my loyalty to you. And as you read through this, maybe you think, well, Ruth's loyalty is directed more at Naomi than it is at anyone else. Remember back in the book of Genesis, whenever Rachel left home, what she did, she took her gods with her. It was common custom, if someone married outside of their religion, for the woman who married to continue worshiping the gods of their fathers and not necessarily convert to Judaism. And although, yes, Jacob served Yahweh, Rachel still worshiped those gods that her fathers served. And so it's not out of line to think that maybe Ruth continued to worship the gods of the Moabites despite marrying into a family that worshiped Yahweh. But I don't really buy into that idea personally. Yes, she says, your God will be my God. But then she makes a statement in verse 17. She says, where you'll die, I'll die, and there be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also if anything but death parts us. The word Lord used that Ruth uses there when she's speaking to Naomi is not Elohim, gods. It's Jehovah. You'll remember about Jehovah. Jehovah is God's covenant name with his people. And so as Ruth is reading here, we do see loyalty to Naomi. But the fact here that she uses the covenant name of God when she's speaking to her mother-in-law tells me that while her loyalty, yes, was to Naomi to a certain degree, it wasn't just to Naomi. As her life unfolds, her confidence in Jehovah is going to be made known, and her faith in Jehovah is going to grow. And I think it's going to become obvious that her faith in God was not simply a byproduct of her relationship and her loyalty to Naomi, but rather Ruth had made a commitment herself that perhaps even influenced her willingness to leave the land of Moab and go back to the land of Judah. And yes, to worship the Lord, as Naomi also worshiped the Lord. And so Ruth and Naomi leave for the plains of Moab, going home, back to Bethlehem. Let's conclude our story, picking up in verse 19, chapter 1. The two of them went until they came to Bethlehem. And it happened when they come to Bethlehem that all the city was excited because of them. And the women said, is this Naomi? But she said to them, do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, and the Lord has brought me home again empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has afflicted me? So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab. Now they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest. So we see the return of Naomi to her hometown of Bethlehem. Modern Bethlehem is today a population of about 15,000 people, estimated by scholars during this time to probably be between 150 to 200 people. We would say, reading this account, that's probably accurate, because it says the women of the city, whenever Naomi and Ruth go back to the land of Bethlehem, whenever they go back to that city, the women of the city recognize her. And they say, is this Naomi? It would have been a large number of people. She probably would have been just been a face in the crowd. We're looking at a small enough population that these people would have been recognized after many years having been gone. They speak to her and they say, is this Naomi? Her response, don't call me that anymore. Don't call me Naomi anymore. Call me Mara. Some scholars have suggested, well, Naomi is changing her name here. I don't really think this is about Naomi changing her name. This is less about her changing her name, and I believe more about demonstrating the significance that names possessed in the Old Testament. She says, her friends, don't call me Naomi any longer. Call me Mara. Well, if you look at what the name Naomi means, it means pleasantness. Naomi, she was Naomi when she left. It means pleasantness. She left full, as she said. Not in the sense because there was a famine, she left with some great amount of wealth, but rather she left full. She left with a husband. She left with sons. She left with a future. She left with pleasantness. But she came back. She didn't have that any longer. She said, don't call me Naomi any longer. Call me Mara. Mara, which means bitter. And she was bitter because of the loss of her sons and her husband. She was bitter because she was empty. Don't call me Mara anymore. Call me. Don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara. And the chapter concludes with verse 22 with this seemingly useless additional fact. They came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. As we continue our study in chapter 2 a month from now in the book of Ruth, you'll understand the significance of this small detail. Let's take just a few moments, though, to look at some application from chapter 1 of Ruth. As we read through this, one of the things that to me stands out as a lesson is the fact that we need to remember God in the good times. God had blessed Naomi. He'd given her a full life. He'd made her life pleasant by giving her a family and blessing her richly in that sense. Just as our God has the right to give, our God also has the right to take away, to bring back, to remove. And isn't that the nature of temporal blessings? Money, possessions, health, happiness. You may have it one minute, but the next minute it could be gone. God may give it to you for a time. He very well may take it away from you. Let me say this. If you have those blessings, enjoy them. Don't just enjoy them. Be thankful for them. And realize that it's the Lord's prerogative to take away that which He's given. Ladies, if all you ever heard from your husbands was whenever you did something wrong, whenever you burned supper, or whenever you let his clothes hang out on the line too long, if all you ever heard from your husband was when you went wrong, how would that make you feel? And I hope that's not the case for any of you. If it is, I'm sincerely sorry. How would you feel if all you ever heard was negative things from your husband? Never a compliment, never a, hey, that meal was great. It'd be a pretty depressing relationship, wouldn't it? How do you think it feels to God when all we ever do is fuss about the bad things that happen? We don't ever take a moment when times are good to say, God, I've got good health, I'm prosperous, I'm happy, things are going well, thank you. But yet so oftentimes that's what dictates our life. Let's remember to thank God in those good times, not just complain in the bad. Secondly, you choose to serve God. We see a loyalty between Ruth and Naomi that's quite obvious in chapter 1. And you might think that she chose to serve God simply because that's what Naomi did. But when we looked at her statement, as she used the covenant name Jehovah in regard to God, it's quite obvious that she isn't talking about Him as just one of the gods or the God that Naomi serves. She's talking about Him using His covenant name because she had made a choice for herself to follow God, to serve God. And that was a choice she had made. Maybe you serve God because of your parents. Maybe you come to this church because of your parents or your grandparents or because of your spouse or because of your children. If that's the case, your loyalty isn't really toward God. It's toward the person you're trying to impress, whoever it is you are coming here for. You make that decision. If you haven't yet, you make that decision to serve God. You make that decision to be a part of this church, not for someone else, but for yourself. And when you do that, when you make your decision to offer God something authentic and real and genuine, you'll find contentment and satisfaction that you didn't have beforehand. And then lastly, the question we've all got to answer tonight, individually, every day of our life, should I stay? Should I go? Orpah and Ruth had this choice. One chose to stay. One chose to go. Let me say this. The choice to stay is easy. And it may provide temporal blessings. As Orpah made that decision to go back to her people, that was the easy path, wasn't it? She wasn't uprooting herself from her family. She was going back to where she was comfortable. She may have even found another husband. She may have lived a blessed life. But let me just say, that choice to stay where it's safe, although it may have those temporal blessings, there's nothing long term. Ruth chose to go. She chose to follow Naomi. She chose to follow the Lord. She chose to go. That choice is hard. I'm not going to lie to you and say it's not. That choice is fraught with difficulties and sacrifices. And as you read through the book of Ruth and you see that while Ruth made the choice to go, it presented unique challenges all of itself. It's hard, but man, those rewards are long-term. Will you make the statement like Ruth? If you choose to follow God, will you go where God goes? That's what Ruth said to Naomi. Where you go, I will go. Will you, if you chosen to follow God. Will you go where God goes? If God takes you somewhere that you don't like, if God calls you to make sacrifices you don't really enjoy, will you follow God where He takes you? Will God's people be your people? Maybe there's a brother or sister that you don't like or you don't get along with, or you just butt heads and can't seem to get along. Will your people be God's people? Will God's people be your people? Will you die like He died? Will you die to the world? Will you die to yourself and to your own desires? Will you die to sin and live for God? If you'll do that, I'll make this promise to you. And it's not a promise I'm making, it's a promise that God made. If you'll die like He died, if you'll follow where He leads, if you'll trust in Him, you'll live like He lived. Ruth made the choice to follow Naomi, to follow the Lord. Same option faces you, and it faces me. Will you stay, brethren, or will you go? Following God may be fraught with challenges and sacrifices all its own, but the reward is beyond comparison than for the one who chooses to stay. If you're here this evening and you need to respond to the Lord's invitation in any way, please do so as we stand and as we sing a song of encouragement.
I have decided to follow Jesus. Bible class at 7. 272, we'll sing the first verse and then we'll be dismissed in prayer.